Welcome to Conversations. I'm your host, Doug Duin, and joining me today is John Sanbanmatsu, assistant professor of the Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts and author of the book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. John, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, okay, so let's just start with the big thing here. The title of the book is The Omnivore's Deception. So explain to me what the deception is that you're talking about.
Sure. So, some listeners, I'm sure, will have figured out, my book is meant to resonate in part with a very famous book published in 2006 by Michael Pollan called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And that book kind of summarized some trends in American culture at the time to make the case for a kind of kinder, more sustainable form of animal agriculture. And so it's a long story, but the meat industry had been coming into kind of a crisis due to the consequences of that industry. And beginning in the early 2000s, we see an attempt to kind of circle the wagons in our culture to defend our exploitation and killing of animals for food. And so The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan was a kind of cultural watershed, a huge runaway bestseller. It's still taught as part of state-mandated curricular programs across the country. So the deception that I refer to is this idea that we can have our meat and our conscience too. I deconstruct the myth of the so-called enlightened omnivore who can participate in the animal economy with a kind of clear conscience. And there are essentially three modes of deception I talk about in the book. The first is the way the animal industry hides the violence and suffering of the system from public view. The second is the way apologists for the system like Pollan and Temple Grandin and Barbara Kingsolver and scores of other people have been telling the public that it's possible to have a humane animal economy, which is not possible. And then the final mode of deception I discuss in the book is self-deception. You know, we just don't want to give up our attachment to the animal system. And so I explain why it's part of our not only moral responsibility, but part of kind of an existential self-reckoning that we need to come to face this violence and cruelty squarely.
So as far as industry goes, I'm never surprised or shocked by the idea of a deception. As far as it goes with others, is it always deception, or is maybe there just a massive misconception that we're missing on this topic?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, under capitalist development, there's always a separation between the way a commodity is produced and what we as a consumer see and get. Right. I mean, so people buy shirts and they don't maybe realize they were produced in sweatshops in Bangladesh or something. So there's a certain amount of hiddenness to the commodity system. And this is especially the case in the animal system. So there's certainly misinformation and also kind of ignorant public ignorance about what's going on. But this is a peculiar issue because people really don't want to know, you know, where their food comes from. And if we have this conceit that we as human beings are, quote, you know, Homo sapiens, man the knower, that we want to know everything. But if I say to my undergrad students in my ethics class, okay, how many of you want to see some atrocity videos of animals in the food system before you go to lunch? You know, they're not gonna want to see it because they're sensitive to seeing other beings, you know, subjected to violence. So it's a complex issue because the whole question of like animal consumption is very intimate for people. Our identity is bound up with food and with certain cultural traditions. So it's an issue that people avoid.
No, 100%. I remember being in high school when Meet Your Meat was out and watching it and talking to people about it. And, you know, a lot of people were just like, no, I don't even want to watch that because nobody wants to be face to face with that kind of thing and then have to make the moral decision that comes along with it. So then the big question is there no ethical way to be a meat eater? I mean, we hear buzzwords like free range or cage free or pasture raised. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, well, there, for people who have cats and dogs, I mean, that's a good place to start, right? We understand that these beings that we invite into our households, into our families, are not human. We understand that they have feelings, they have a sophisticated cognition, they're capable of love, curiosity. Science shows that all animals really are susceptible to trauma and so on. So if someone came into our home and did extreme violence, enacted extreme violence against one of our companions, we would understand that that is just wrong and that there would be no, quote, humane way to shoot or stab our companion to death. So we have this idea that we can eliminate, quote, unnecessary suffering in the animal food system, and that animals will only suffer in as much as it is necessary for them to die violently. And that is simply, it, just to think about it on the face of it, it's absurd. But then if you look at all of these operations that claim to be humane, as you said, cage-free and humanely killed and pasture raised and all that. And there have been exposés of all this and how they're, for example, the Chipotle chain of restaurants has been engaged in deceiving the public about where it gets its, where its suppliers get the animal products from, and they end up, some of them, from industrialized agriculture, in other words, factory farms. We find animals being gassed in gas chambers in organic farming operations. That's an increasingly popular thing. And Temple Grandin, for example, is a huge advocate of using gas chambers on animals. Well, the animals in gas chambers suffer in the same way that humans put in gas chambers suffer. They're mammals, we're mammals. Well, birds, same thing. I mean, they're just as sensitive to these things. And I understand, you know, I was a meat eater. I grew up that way. But most people want to do well by animals. But there's a kind of cognitive dissonance because we kind of want to have our meat and eat it too. That is to say, we want to be able to think there's a kind way to inflict violence on other beings, to control their sexuality, mutilate their bodies for reproduction, and so forth. And there just isn't. There isn't a way to do that.
And on top of that, I think we hear a lot about the health risks, health benefits, as well as probably some things that may be propagandized or maybe just misunderstood, like going vegan, the health risks of, you know, possibly anemia, iron deficiency. What are the health risks / health benefits of changing your diet this way?
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me because there are so many myths about eating animals and then not eating animals that you need a kind of a chainsaw to cut through them. And this is one of the ones that really astonishes me because almost every study that's been done about the nutritional consequences of vegetarianism and veganism shows that they are superior in their health outcomes compared to people who are on an animal diet or, quote, omnivorous diet. I mean, and I'm not talking about like people speculating on some vegan website. I'm talking about The Lancet or JAMA, in other words, the top medical journals in the world that have found consistently that people on a plant-based diet have lower rates of cholesterol, heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes. They live longer. Think about that. That actually, the evidence suggests that vegans live longer than people who are eating animal products. Now, I'm not saying that you can't be healthy on an animal diet. That'd be silly too. But the argument that somehow veganism poses health risks is just, it's the opposite. The only thing that vegans don't normally get as through plant consumption is vitamin B12. But that's like, it's not in the same way that people, you know, manufacturers in the dairy industry put vitamin D in cow's milk, right? Everybody drinks that. So that's all you'd have to do is put B12 in something. And so I personally have been vegan for over 30 years. And I think I'm in pretty good shape for someone who's as ancient as I am.
Well, aside from health benefits, health risks of both styles of eating, then talk to me about possibly a bigger thing in the public perception right now, the ecology of animal yes. farming. How does that affect the ecosystem that we live in?
So I talk about two giant systems, structures of power and domination that are literally leading to the collapse of the planet's ecology. One, people will have heard of, it's capitalism, which commodifies nature and reduces all of nature to a commodity to be produced for profit, right? So, you know, just the destruction of the earth through that system is massive, and it's been well documented, you know. But there's this other system that we don't talk about, which scholars refer to as speciesism. It's kind of a difficult word, you know, it's not a pleasant word, speciesism. But it's simply human domination of all the other life forms on the earth. We just don't think anything of putting a highway through the living spaces of other beings, or setting out poison for mice, or spraying nerve gas on, you know, a colony of wasps in the backyard, etc. Now, these two systems come together in a confluence in the animal food system. And what people don't understand, actually, is that the animal food system, is the number one most ecologically damaging force on the earth today. Animal agriculture kills, in animal agriculture, we kill about 80 billion land animals every year. And in the fishing industry, we're killing up to 2.7 trillion marine animals every single year. So quite apart from the suffering and horror of that violence, it's literally undermining the existence of all life on Earth. We're in the middle of a mass species extinction event, the worst in over 65 million years. It's a bigger problem, actually, than global warming, and no one talks about it. But all the birds, all the animals of the Earth are dying. Birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, invertebrates, insects, spiders, and in the sea, fishes and crustaceans and cephalopods and on and on and on. So we can't keep this up because the animal food system is tearing up the web of life. And so my book is really partly to show people what's hidden, to show them the extent of this violence, and to ask that we all, you know, confront it and move on. You know, it's time to just shut down this entire system of violence.
Well, you mentioned it towards the top of this conversation that we're having, that our identities are tied into the things that we eat. And I feel like this lifestyle that you're living has been massively politicized, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. even down to like gender roles, like eating a salad isn't manly. How do you combat, you know, that type of thinking?
Yeah. Well, I want to say, first of all, the veganism, it some people do treat it as a lifestyle, but in general, I really think of it as a social justice issue. You know, it's not just like a choice of diet. It's like saying, it's choosing a different set of values, political and social and ethical values, to live by. And meat in particular is not like any other commodity because of our attachments to it. And it's always been gendered, as you point out. I mean, in 1990, a scholar named Carol Adams wrote an influential book called The Sexual Politics of Meat. And she traced through the centuries how men have always been assumed to need more meat. You know, there's some connection between masculinity and dominating and killing animals, such that even today, most hunters and fishers are men. Something like 80% of hunters and fishers remain men. And if you look at the magazines, and there are just hundreds of these things about hunting, for example, you know, you see these guys in camouflage with infrared scopes and hollow point bullets, and it's like they're waging war against these defenseless creatures. And unfortunately, in the manosphere in particular, we're seeing a reassertion of this historical connection between meat eating, machismo, masculinity. So it's, again, meat is not like other commodities that way. It's really tied to our identities, including our gender identities. So, you know, I and others are pushing back against that. But you have to understand that the attacks that we constantly see against vegans and vegetarians and so forth is part of a general right-wing backlash against movements of social justice throughout society. Yeah, so farmers in the U.S. and Europe are drifting towards the extreme right. Farmers in the U.S. voted overwhelmingly for Trump. In Europe, we find them drifting to fascist parties against efforts by the European Union and state authorities to mitigate the problems of climate change that are simply endemic within animal agriculture. So it's not an accident that, you know, animal advocates are feminized. They're seen as effeminate, and in fact, the right wing calls liberals soy boys. I don't know if you ever heard that expression, but yeah, the idea is that liberals are all vegans and wusses and so on. So yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, and I do go into that in depth in my book.
Does that come down a bit to messaging? Because I'm sure the farmers are being told their way of life is being attacked. You know, you're being replaced. It's just immediate. Or secondarily, is perfect sometimes the enemy of good? Like, is there's an expectation that if you're told, hey, you should reduce or eliminate your meat consumption, that you hear you're either perfect, or if you have meat once a week from five times a week, you're still the problem. So is it a messaging? Are we allowing perfect to be the enemy of good?
Well, you know, as a moral philosopher, I think that what's one of the things that's so strange about this particular issue of like our ethical relations with or duties towards other animals is that in no other domain of our existence would we equate one form of action with its opposite. For example, no one would say that caring for an elderly person is neither better nor worse than shoving them down the stairs, right? Or raising children in a loving way is neither better nor worse than cutting their throats. Okay, I know that's a little extreme. But the fact is that in our society, right, every form of behavior towards other animals is not only tolerated, but monetized, right? So if you love cats and dogs, there's $1 billion into the pet industry for that, right? Where you can love your animal, take them on trips and so on. And at the same time, while you're on your trip, you're going to be eating chickens and pigs and cows, who, by the way, we know from the science, are absolutely no less cognitively sophisticated, emotionally complex, capable of affection as are cats and dogs. So, but society levels those out, right, as though they're the same. So in terms of, you know, this question of perfection, I mean, if I say, well, I'm a racist, but I'm only going to be racist on Tuesdays and Fridays, you know, or I'm only going to commit assault on Sundays, you know, we would say, what are you, nuts? So there's something about this issue where people can't seem to grasp that so here's the question. The question is whether it is just, whether it's right, what we're doing to other animals and in instrumentalizing them, causing them despair and suffering, and then inflicting violence on them. If we agree, and that's the question, right? But if we determine as a society that this is just not right, then I don't think there's a middle ground, right? For one thing, there have been attempts to regulate animal agriculture and our exploitation of animals for literally thousands of years. I mean, you can find injunctions against certain forms of abuses in the Old Testament, you know, in the Torah and so on. So that kind of approach just doesn't work, because right now we're killing and exploiting more animals than ever in human history. Per capita meat consumption is up. The number of animals in factory farming is up. So other than a moratorium on this violence, I don't see any way out.
So insofar as that, there's also the, like you mentioned, the public perception, you know, things like, mm-hmm. like calling someone a soy boy. How important do you think to make any change, that you'd need to change the public perception of veganism. I mean, you hear things all the time, disparaging things like, how do you know someone's vegan? Don't worry, they'll tell you, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
you know, I think people don't want to feel judged. And so how do you change that perception without it feeling like you're judging people? Because, I mean, back to the same point that you just made, and I understand completely, but a person eats meat 7 days a week and they're like, you know what, I'm going to go down to one. And it feels like that's just not good enough, and it may not be, but it's a huge improvement, and it feels like the message comes out as no improvement is good enough. And I think it doesn't allow, it kind of pushes that a little bit more into the frontal cortex of people, that they start to feel like, well, I may as well not even try.
Oh, yeah, no. And let me clarify. I'm glad you said that, because I'm not saying that, you know, everyone listening to this should tomorrow become a vegan. I mean, if you can, great. But, you know, it'll take time for most people. They have to transition, you know. There is a social stigma to it. There's all the incentives in our society run the opposite way right now. So I get that. So that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that people should change on a dime, because that may be hard for people. What I'm saying is that what I ask people to do in the book is to, first of all, take this issue seriously, which they don't, most people don't. And secondly, to follow it through to its logical conclusion. If we decide, again, that what we're doing is wrong, then we need to make the commitment to change. You know what I'm saying? Rather than, oh, I'm only going to participate in this injustice some of the time. Well, maybe that's true in the short term, but hopefully in the long term, one is committed to overcoming that, if that makes any sense to you. There have been studies that show that making fun of vegans, demonizing and ridiculing vegans, it's so interesting. Vegans and vegetarians are the only group in the United States that it is considered socially acceptable to make fun of. Like, you can't make fun of, I'm not going to say, this group or that group. That's no longer acceptable in polite company. But this is something that everybody can agree on, right? Universally, that animal rights and so forth is it's fair game for late night comics. I mean, oh my God, I can't tell you how many TV shows and movies I've seen that where they're always making fun of animal advocates or vegans. Well, why is that? Why does society have this need, right, to defend against this idea that, and remember, all the vegan is saying is, hey, all this, you know, the killing of trillions of animals, I don't want to participate in that. It's not even like the vegans are going around and taking meat off people's tables. They're just saying, hey, I don't want to do that, and maybe you should think about that. And that just makes people crazy, right? They cannot hear that. So in terms of changing public perception, I mean, that is why I wrote my book, right, is to overcome some of the myths that people have about this issue, and to argue, as I do, that far from this being a trivial issue, I think it's the most important issue of our time. I mean, what could be more important, first of all, than the ecology of our planet, and secondly, the quality of our own souls? Because as long as we engage in these behaviors, we're kind of making our whole species into the demon of the earth. We have enslaved all the other beings. And it's not necessary. That's the crazy thing about this.
Yeah, and again, I'm talking to John Sanbonmatsu, author of the book, The Omnivore's Deception, What We Get Wrong About Meat, Animals, and Ourselves. First of all, I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you. And before I let you go, is there any like lasting message that you want people to walk away from this conversation with? Something that they should take with them and let gestate and marinate?
Yeah, you know, we have this search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you know, scientists looking in the cosmos for signs of other intelligent life. My message is that this planet is full of other forms of intelligent life, other suffering, thinking, feeling beings, and it's time that we relented in our violence against them and saw them with compassion and respect. And that means dismantling the animal food economy. And having a discussion about it, at least, rather than kind of defending against it psychologically, which isn't productive. I mean, it's really time for us to have a debate about this at a national level.
Well, John, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. And just thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Doug.
Yeah, and thank you for listening. Conversations is a public affairs program of the station.